Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. What is the journey like from growing up in a cult to succeeding on Wall Street? Well, my guest knows. Patricia Walsh Chadwick is author of Breaking Glass, Tales from the Witch of Wall Street. It's published by Post Hill Press. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Patricia, go to patriciachadwick.com, and you can follow her on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and YouTube. And Patricia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. So quite the life so far, huh?
Yes.
What? Tell us about how in the world did you grew up in such an unusual environment. So to share your little early life with us, and then we'll get into your adventures in the career side of things, but just the fact that you grew up in a cult. Can you share with our audience a little bit about that?
Sure. I was born into it. It was actually a religious community that tragically, over a number of years, morphed into being a cult and had all the telltale signs of a cult. But when I wrote my first book, which is called Little Sister, I wasn't even comfortable saying that. Now, 5 years later, with my second book, I've accepted the fact that it did turn into a cult, very tragically, and the people were manipulated in terrible ways. Children were separated from their parents. We were 39 children and 60 adults. We were expected to stay with the community for life, be celibate, and be nuns as girls, or brothers. And along around the time I turned 14, I started to have crushes on boys and men in the community, which was obviously a bad signal with regard to how I might fare as a nun. And we were educated within our community. We never went out for all intents and purposes. None of us ever saw a television show, listened to the radio, read newspapers, never went to a supermarket. I never even held a dollar bill in my life. And when I was 17, the woman that ran the place, and there was a pair of people, there was this Jesuit priest, Father Feeney, who was quite renowned. And then the woman, the power behind the throne, was a woman named Catherine Clark, whom we all referred to as Sister Catherine. And at the beginning of my senior year in high school, she called me in and had my mother there, something very unusual, and basically told me that at the end of the school year, I would have to leave. And actually didn't really explain why, other than she said, some people do not have a vocation. Well, she was very right about that. But what she didn't help me at all with was how was I to migrate from this incredibly restrictive environment where I knew nothing about the outside world to being kind of tossed into it with my parents and my four younger siblings staying behind. And so there I was, knowing nothing, had heard a swear word or even a slang word. I didn't know a single movie star name. I didn't know sports. All I knew, I was forced to come out. She did not allow me to go to college, despite the fact that I had been accepted at both Vassar and Bates College. But she said it would be the ruination of my son. Barely had me apply and get accepted so that the school would be accredited. And she allowed us how I might go to secretarial school. Oh, that's exactly what happened. But I had my eyes and ears open and my mouth shut because I knew nothing.
That's got to be frightening when you come into the larger culture from that kind of background. Again, I referred to it in the opening and subsequently in our conversation as a cult, and you said it started out as a religious organization or commune or living arrangement, and then became what in essence was a cult. What part of the country was this in?
This started off in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a pretty intellectual environment. And I will tell you honestly, the adult members of the community were highly educated, very, very intellectual. We had people from around the world. It was Syria and Lebanon and Italy and Spain. And for me, it was a very stimulating environment intellectually, but also very, very rigid. And so, I remember one time shortly after I was kicked out, I was on a bus, and a man sitting next to me turned to me and said, "Has anyone ever told you you look like Lauren Bacall?" I had no idea what he was talking about. I had no idea Lauren Bacall. And I just said, Lauren Bacall, remember that name, figure out who she is. And that evening, I was seeing my mother, whom I addressed as Sister Elizabeth Ann, never called her mother. And I said, "Sister Elizabeth Ann, who is Lauren Bacall?" And she was still very much a nun. I was just in my first few weeks of being out. And she, I think, made a slip, because normally nobody would talk about anybody in the outside world. And she turned to me and she said, "Oh, darling," she was a beautiful actor. And I thought, oh, and suddenly it clicked in my head, that man sitting next to me must be beautiful. Nobody had ever said anything about whether I was pretty, ugly, or whatever. I never thought about it that way. But it was fascinating. I mean, that's how socially naive I was, or culturally naive I was.
Did that have an effect on you in terms of not just general social life, but in terms of interacting with men and any romantic relationships? Did that affect you to the point where you were gun shy, for want of a better term?
Did take on, but I was interested in men. But I mean, that did not come really for probably a good year after I was out. I needed to have my footing. And I also was, you know, not very aggressive at exploring. On the other hand, once I started to get my sea legs, I was exploring. And one day I did a very, very stupid thing, and I hitchhiked. And I was in Boston, and all I wanted to do was go across the river to Cambridge. I knew I shouldn't do it. I knew full well I shouldn't, but I thought, I'm just going to try it. The next thing I knew, I was 45 minutes outside of Boston, and I was terrified. And I gathered up all my strength, because I kept thinking, pretty soon there are going to be no more red lights. Pretty soon he's going to be able to have me do whatever he wants to do. And so I screamed at the top of my voice and said to him, "You around right now and back into Harvard Square." And astonishingly, he looked at me and he said, "Okay." And he did it.
Wow.
So I think that was.
Yeah, it sounds like you had a very strong will even in the early stages of your life then. Despite the background in the cult, you were able to somehow summon that will to survive and prosper.
I had to survive. The only option I had was to survive. I didn't even know what thriving was, but there was so few places to turn for advice. And so doing something as stupid as that could have been life-threatening. Mm-hmm. And the only solution I had was to be as aggressive as I could be. And I guess he probably thought, I don't want to tangle with this one. So he turned around and brought me back.
Were you when you finally got to a point where you were in secretarial school and you eventually got into the financial and investment world, were you able to apply lessons from your earlier life to your then became your new life, or were there lessons you chose to forget and just had to learn through social cues, perhaps mentors or friends?
That's a very wonderful question. There was a lot I brought from my life. My education was great. I knew I had, I could speak the King's English, and I knew that that was helpful when I went for an interview, when I engaged with people. My community, we had social contact. We had been taught manners. I had had 6 years of Latin. I had had a year of classical Greek. I knew I was well-educated. But I had to, you know, with the cards I was dealt. And so for me, it was important to make the most of what I had that was valuable. And there was a lot there. And I will tell you one interesting thought that's only come to me when I've written this second book. I had discovered invaluable blessings that I had had. And within the center, the titular head was a priest named Father Feeney. But the power behind the throne was a woman, Catherine Clark, whom we called Sister Catherine. She made all the rules. There were 60 men and women. Not one of them ever defied her. 39 children, of course, we would never defy her. And she ran the place with an iron hand, and nobody said no to her. And I think subliminally, she was not a mentor to me in any way, shape, or form, but she was a role model. And I think when I ended up in the world of Wall Street, which is pretty much a male bastion, it never occurred to me that something might be beyond my capabilities, or it didn't frighten me that there were men all around, because I think I had this image, this lived experience running everything, so it didn't seem odd at all to me to be thrown into having to make decisions. I say that only with the benefit of hindsight and having thought a lot about it as I was writing this second book.
Mm-hmm. The difference I see in your background is when you talk to people, some people who have been in various cults or religious cults, non-religious cults, just whatever you want to term it, a lot of them come from the position of the females in the group are not necessarily highly educated or know, as you mentioned, Latin, for example. So that's unusual that although it was what it was, you still had some education. You still were able to know certain things.
Yes, I did have a very wonderful and very classical education. And there was one person. So as I mentioned, my book is dedicated to my mentors, all of whom were men once I got out, even at the role of, secretary and receptionist, I had mentors. But I put one woman in that list, and she wasn't a mentor to me once I was out in the world, as we called it. She was a mentor to me while I was at the center, and it wasn't my mother, and it wasn't my father. She was the principal of our school. She had been educated at Radcliffe, and she had taught me in the second grade and the seventh grade and the 12th grade. She taught me violin. She taught me trumpet. And she did that not just for me. She did that for 38 other children. She was the most dedicated, teacher in the world. And in those last few months when I was there, and I knew I was going to be leaving, and I was really terrified, she would call me into one of the small classrooms we had in the afternoon. No one else was around. And she would just sit and tell me things like, "You're going to do really well because you have common sense." And she would say things like, now remember, we didn't call our parents mom and dad. She would refer to my parents and she would say, "You have the best of Brother James Aloysius and Sister Elizabeth Ann," which was what we called them. And that made me feel so good. Someone was bucking me up. Sister Catherine never, never did that. And I remembered that when I was out in the world and alone. And ever after that, every year I would go up and visit her. She remained a nun until she died only 4 or 5 years ago at the age of 98. And I would go and visit her every year. And I owe her so much. So I put her in as a role model for me, both a role model and a mentor. Sister what? Catherine was never a mentor, even though she was my godmother. Mm-hmm. And I could not make headway with her.
I want to talk to you about the Wall Street adventures, but before that, one thing that still intrigues me is that what was the motivation of this group of people who, as you indicated, are highly educated and yet get together in a very small group and have very rigid rules, educate their people, but also at the same time say, "You're going to be a nun, you're going to be this," and a highly regulated. And they had access to the outside world because it came from the outside world.
That is true, but they were forced to relinquish all their relationships with everyone in the outside world, except for Sister Catherine. She would go home to her family 3 nights a week, but the rest, husbands and wives, were separated, which also very much in the signal of a cult.
But I guess I get my point. My point, though, is that these are highly educated people that have agreed to be part of this cult.
There was one defining theme was the glue that held them together. They all took a very strong opinion. I agree, it was quite doctrinaire, that you had to be Catholic to be saved, to go to heaven. It was a very anti-Semitic environment. The Jews had killed Jesus. Therefore, they were a cast out part of society as far as they were concerned. And they believed in that dogma, no salvation outside the Catholic Church. I used to find it troubling thinking, are we going to be the only people in heaven? It just didn't seem to make any sense.
Yeah, it's a very small group.
A very small group.
Well, somehow you make it to Wall Street. And again, the title of your book is Breaking Glass, Tales from the Witch of Wall Street. How in the world did you get that name, Witch of Wall Street? You mentioned earlier that it was a male-dominated group. Obviously, when you get into Wall Street, I don't know that it's as much now as it was then, but was it I'm surprised they didn't call you Witch, but with a B instead of W.
Well, that may have been what they wanted to say. I don't know. But I thought about it because I only found that out a few years ago. And it struck me that I was very aggressive. There's no doubt about that. And I've learned over thinking about it and trying to write this second book, characteristics are defined as leadership qualities in a man, aggressiveness and impatience and, you know, moving ahead as rapidly as you can, you know, being a perfectionist. Those are considered qualities and maybe get a man called the Wolf of Wall Street. But when they're also demonstrated by a woman, they seem to get her to be called the Witch of Wall Street, or maybe you're right, maybe a different letter on the front of it. And I decided that, you know, at first I was dismayed. But after a while, I said, so what? I'm going to let it be a badge of honor. I mean, I don't deny that I broke some china along the way, but I also tried to be a mentor to younger people. I was impatient. I had endless energy. But you know, one of the things that I think helped me all along was I always had my hand up in the air to say, yes, I'll do that. And I think that that was a very important element in my success, to be adaptable. You know, I talk about having resilience and I talk about, you know, having gratitude, and I have so much gratitude. But the fact of the matter is, maybe people think, well, I don't feel as though I'm a resilient person, but you can be an adaptable person. Mm-hmm. And you can say yes, and you can say, of course I'll do that. And when you do that, you build up confidence in yourself. And when you build up confidence, resilience is a lot easier. And I think that that served me very, very well. And even as a always helping the brokers get their lunches for them, cutting articles off the ticker tape for them, and doing things like that. And I had only been a receptionist for 15 months when the lead partner came to me one day and said, we're closing a deal in New York tomorrow. We'd like you to go to New York, take the shuttle. There'll be a car that will pick you up. We need you to go to 5 separate investors. Each of them has $1 million. You need to collect those 5 $1 million checks and bring them back so we can close the deal. I didn't even know what a deal was. And I figured that closing a deal was probably a good thing since I was going to carry $5 million in my hand. And I wasn't even 21. I was 20 years old. And the next day, when I came back, and it was about 6 o'clock in the evening when I got there, and I gave them the $5 million. And they said, let's go out and celebrate at the Ritz-Carlton restaurant, mm-hmm. the restaurant at the Ritz-Carlton. And I did. And I remember lying in bed that night and thinking, maybe I could have the life they have someday. It was a huge, of confidence that he had in me, that I would go down to New York, get this done and come back. And I wasn't even 21 at the time. So that to me, and that's why I consider that partner first mentor. I had been working 2 hours, and 6 later, he gave me a raise. And I did the calculation on an annualized basis. I had just gotten a 22% raise. I went, wow, that's really good. 2 months later, it was my first year. I'd only been a receptionist for 9 months. And at Christmas time, he gave me a $1,500 bonus. And I thought, bonus? Why do I get a bonus? So, I mean, then I got used to having a bonus. And that was nice.
Human
nature. But I loved what I did. In moments when I was afraid I would get bored as a receptionist, I would memorize all the stock symbols on the New York Stock Exchange. And so within a year, I could tell you every stock symbol was. And I also got my broker's license before I was 21.
That's impressive. And then you're, again, in a male-dominated world, yet you're able to thrive in it, not just survive, but thrive in it.
And frankly, I may have been called the Witch of Wall Street, but I had some great, great, great relationships with a lot of men. But, you know, remember, in coming through Wall Street, I was a research analyst, and I covered the machinery sector of the economy. And so my days were spent going out and meeting with the CEOs and CFOs, all of whom were men, of these giant manufacturing companies. And I loved that. I found it so exhilarating. And frankly, I was very pleased that I was assigned, when I moved to New York, I was given the job of being a machinery analyst as opposed to maybe being a retail analyst or being a cosmetics analyst. I really loved learning that hard scrabble way of being in these giant manufacturing facilities and learning, you know, firsthand how things were made. Loud noises. It was fun.
Was there a realization that you had an edge in a way, because it was rare that a female would be meeting with these manufacturing executives, and here you are showing up and they're used to seeing a guy and here's a female? And did it work for you in a sense that they were just delighted that it was not the typical investment guy coming or the typical researcher coming?
I think they were only interested in how they spent their time, frankly. And if you ask stupid questions, I don't think they would have had any interest. You know, you really had to prepare and work hard. And I do remember in 1981 when I went to Japan, and Peter Vermilia at Citibank had said to me, "I want you to go over there. Everybody says Japan's going to be the next, you know, they're going to conquer all the United States companies. Go and figure it out." Now, there was an unusual situation because there were hardly any working women in Japan. And I had to have an interpreter. So, of course, I had no idea what they were saying when I would ask my question. And I sometimes started to think they might have been talking about me, because I would ask a very simple question. They would carry on for 5 minutes, and then they would give me a monosyllabic answer. And I thought, you know, they have never dealt with women. But, I mean, there weren't many women in the machinery arena. And I mean, I suppose there's a certain engagement that male and female might enjoy each other, but boy, you better be tough as nails and you better know exactly. If you ask stupid questions, they would have had no time, and they wouldn't have given me time for another interview.
So it was the same as when you met the executives at the manufacturing plants, whether it's the United States or in Japan where you're meeting with people, it's the same thing. Your questions have to be to the point. Otherwise, they're not going to waste their time with you.
Mentality in the manufacturing sector in Japan, market share was very, very important. Market share can come at the cost of profits. And I learned that, and it was a very, very good lesson to take home from that wonderful trip I took in Japan in 1981.
Part of your life also includes your personal. You get married, you have a kid. And that did you ever envision yourself as a mother initially, given your background with the cult?
Oh, yes. As a child, I had this fantasy that I would be sitting in a beautiful garden and a prince would come by and take me by the hand and up into the sky and take me to a castle. You know, what's a girl going to do when there's a red fence around and you can't see anything outside? But once I was in the, I always knew I wanted to have a family, to be a mother, to raise my children. But when I married my husband, he already had 3 children, and they were teenagers at that time. And I thought, Patricia, you know, you want to be an excellent employer. How can you also be an excellent mother? And I let myself believe that that might have been a challenge until my 40th birthday. And I realized, you better say something soon. And I did. And John was amazing and wonderful. And for the next 5 years, we moved heaven and earth in every form of science. And at the age of 45, I had my twins.
Pretty impressive.
And to me, it was just the most wonderful thing. And so then I had to have these three balances, you know, my husband, my work, and my children. And I decided that I would just slow down a bit. But the fact of the matter is the business is very aggressive. And so I found myself going and going and going and going. And finally, the children were 5 years old and we were on a vacation up in Rhode Island on the ocean. And one day John came home and he said, you know, I've spent the whole day on the beach with the children and you spent the whole day on conference calls. And I really took to heart what he said. And I lay in bed awake a lot of that night. And the following morning when I got up, I said, John, I've made my decision tomorrow. Or it was a Labor Day weekend. So on Monday or Tuesday, when I go into the office, I'm going to retire. I'm going to tell them I'm retiring at the end of the year. And that is exactly what I did. I left Wall Street when my children, I really wanted to be the one to answer their questions. It's fine when they're really, really little and there are play dates and things like that. Mm-hmm. But once they started being in school, I wanted to be there. I wanted to be part of that involvement. And so I left without any plans for the future. But I had been doing a lot of TV work. And so I got called by someone who said, I see you on TV all the time. I think you'd make an excellent expert witness. And all of a sudden, a second career came up as an expert witness and also as a board member of corporations and financial companies. And so a second career blossomed entirely. And then about 8 years ago, I co-founded a company which provides healthcare to the LGBTQ community. And I'm the pro bono CEO of that. And we have about 4,000 patients. We're based in Connecticut. And that's been another calling of sorts. And meanwhile, I've done a lot of mentoring of young women, high school, college age, young women. And I find that hugely rewarding. And I think I benefited so much from the mentors in my life that I really feel an obligation to do it.
Before I let you go, one final question. And what do you want people to take away from reading your book?
I think it would be great if they take away that you can be very much involved in your own career path. You have to put your effort into it. And that adaptability is a very, very strong criterion for making others see you as value added. I had no idea what I was going to be when I was kicked out. And so you don't have to know in advance. You have to take advantage of the opportunities that come from you and learn to engage with people and look for mentors. There's no such thing as a bad mentor. Mentors are always valuable to you.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Patricia Walsh Chadwick, author of Breaking Glass, Tales from the Witch of Wall Street. It's published by Post Hill Press, and it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Patricia, go to patriciachadwick.com, patriciachadwick.com, and you can follow her on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and YouTube. And Patricia, thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.